When it comes to Pennsylvania school funding, it pays to shrink. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Most public school funding in the Keystone State comes from local taxes, and there are clearly districts that win or lose depending on local wealth. State dollars are supposed to help level the playing field, but those allocations are largely disconnected from actual student need and are informed instead by 25-year-old population data. Keystone Crossroads' Kevin McCory takes us to Reading and Port Allegheny, whose student populations have shifted in very different ways over the past quarter century.
By any objective measure, Reading School District is one of the most challenged in the state. Median household income is under $27,000. The concentration of deep poverty is staggering, and 2 in 10 kids in the district are learning English. But the state doesn't systematically recognize these factors when deciding how to dole out the bulk of its funding.
It creates just a confluence of issues with educating our students in the city of Reading. It's not adequate.
That's Reading Superintendent Khalid Mumin. The real kicker, he says, is that Reading's school population has risen over the past few decades. You'd think that mean more state funding, but quite the opposite. In 1991, the state implemented a hold harmless policy that said that districts would never get less state support if they lost enrollment. Conversely, districts that gained students didn't see requisite increases, and so they've had to stretch their dollars further to cover more kids. Mumin says if you look around his schools, you'll see a clear impact.
You're seeing a lot of teachers, but I would say not enough. You're seeing counselors and counseling services, but not enough. I think we need more.
This year, lawmakers implemented a new student-weighted formula to its funding distributions, and notably, it counts actual enrollment. This begins to rectify the past, but the new formula is only being applied to a very small slice of state money, so the older dynamic is still baked in. That slice will get bigger year after year as new dollars are allocated, and so most lawmakers say time will heal all wounds. House Majority Leader Dave Reed is an Indiana County Republican.
More and more money will be put into that formula and help balance the disparity. It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take some time, but we've got to allow the school districts to adjust as it occurs.
Reed says that implementing the formula too rapidly would too severely hurt the districts that have lost enrollment over time. Take, for example, the tiny, poor northwestern district of Port Allegheny, which has lost 30% of its school population since the early 90s. Currently, it's near the top in per-pupil state funding. But with full implementation of the new fair funding formula, its state funding would be cut by more than 40%. Gary Buxton is superintendent.
If you're going to cut, in effect, half of the state subsidy to districts like Port Allegheny, they truly would have a very difficult time keeping their doors open. For us to make that up, we basically have to triple taxes.
Buxton also pushed back on the idea of cutting staff or programs.
We don't want to deny our kids in Port Allegheny or in this part of the state the same opportunities that other students have throughout the Commonwealth.
But that's exactly what has been happening in the districts like Reading that have been historically shorted by the lack of a formula. David Mozenkis is the education researcher for the faith-based group Power, which mainly advocates for another district in the same boat, Philadelphia. He's not moved by Port Allegheny's argument.
You should compare the decimation that would happen there to the decimation that has been going on now for years and decades in some of these urban districts that have had to do with such underfunding with the great needs that they have.
Many education advocates think this is an unproductive debate. Instead of taking from a district like Port Allegheny and giving to a district like Reading, they say we should be adding billions more dollars to the pot so there's enough money across the board. Michael Churchill is an attorney with the Public Interest Law Center, a nonprofit that's handling a lawsuit against the state over education funding.
The fact is, if we were funding this correctly, there would be very, very few losers.
But billions of new dollars, of course, would require significant statewide tax increases, similar to those called for by Governor Tom Wolf during his first budget cycle. Those proposals, like ones calling for a more aggressive implementation of the formula, have failed to garner widespread support. But that doesn't mean there isn't room for optimism among educators. The fact that the state now actually uses a student-weighted funding formula at all has Reading Superintendent Mumin feeling good. Reading still can't afford all the staff it needs, but it does have a greater ability to plan and invest for the future.
that alone, that gets me to do a backflip. From a morale standpoint, it really has energized my teaching staff and administrators and support staff because they know, hey, we're not forgotten. People do recognize what's going on here. People do recognize that we need help.
Kevin McCory, Keystone Crossroads.
Check out the interactive map at keystonecrossroads.org to see how enrollment has changed in your district. Long before the ascendancy of tweets and television, protest posters were a preferred way to broadcast dissenting viewpoints. Temple History Professor Ralph Young's new book, Make Art, Not War, Political Protest Posters from the 20th Century, focuses on the form. Professor Young, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Well, thank you for having me.
And though this does focus on the 20th century, you do certainly allude to antecedents going all the way back to the colonial era.
Yes, I do. And, you know, a lot of the posters from that period of time were political cartoons and broadsides, especially in the 18th century in the lead up towards the American Revolution. Benjamin Franklin's Pennsylvania Gazette, of course, was one of the really important parts of this.
Why did you choose to focus, though, on the 20th century and primarily from World War II on?
Well, this was basically going through the posters at the Tamament Collection in the New York University Library. This was a collection of posters that was in the Robert Wagner Labor Archives. And it starts pretty much in the 1930s.
With the labor movement?
With a lot of labor movement posters. Some of the posters are by the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, which still exists, even though the government pretty much cracked down on it during World War I. But some of the posters are during the Vietnam War that the IWW then put out, opposing the draft and the war itself.
So where the aforementioned colonial era posters, political cartoons rather, were in newspapers at the time, these posters you're alluding to, were they in magazines or tacked up on walls or poles?
Some of them were in magazines, but most of them were meant to be printed in mass quantities and then tacked up on walls or on telephone poles or any place where people can see them.
As we're considering political posters, I'm wondering if some might consider the iconic Barack Obama 2008 campaign poster, Hope Change, in this same category.
Yes, yes, that is considered in that. And in a sense, Obama's election, even one could say, of course, it was not an act of dissent in a way. However, in a sense, Obama himself is like the proof of how some dissent movements do have success. And I remember being very touched by a scene when I was watching the inauguration on television on January 20th, 2009. As Obama was approaching the lectern, John Lewis, the congressman, stepped out and shook his hand as he was going down, like, you know, Obama was shaking everybody's hand, and John Lewis was shaking his hand, and he whispered something to him, and I thought, I would love to hear what he's saying. The next day in the New York Times, there was a little piece about it, and it said that John Lewis said to Obama, "Congratulations, Mr. Obama, on becoming president," and Obama's response to him was, "It's because of you," expressing that the Freedom Rides, the March on Selma, the sit-ins, all of this was what made January 20th, 2009 possible.
Are we talking about a bygone era, or has the heyday of political posters passed? Again, on the top, talking about the ascendancy of tweets and television.
You know, two of the most really important methods of expressing dissenting opinions that really get the message out in a very visceral, quick way are through art, through posters, and through music. You know, people can listen to a song and it'll trigger something off in them that a two-hour speech might not. And in some ways, we can think of political protest posters and protest songs as the social media of their day. This is the way people got out a message that was different from the mainstream message. And I think the roles of both of these forms are being taken over by Twitter and Facebook and other social media outlets, that people are getting out that alternative message and they don't need to do as much with posters or with songs.
Professor, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Well, thank you.
Temple History Professor Ralph Young, his new book is entitled Make Art, not war, political protest posters from the 20th century. Still ahead, tickets to productions by one local theater company will set you back. Well, that's up to you.
There's a sense of, I'm making a decision about what this evening has been worth for me.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. The mayor of West York, Pennsylvania, recently sparked major public backlash over racist Facebook posts. He eventually acquiesced to demands for his resignation, which came from every corner, including the governor, putting the borough of 4,500 uncomfortably on the map. The incident highlighted the limited options that Pennsylvanians have for removing an elected official from power. Keystone Crossroads' Emily Previty took a closer look.
The posts at Focus include one from June of a monkey saying it is a picture of Michelle Obama. Another hints at lynching the president. And yet another describes racism as whites' justified anger. West York Mayor Charles Wasco initially resisted calls to step down. Then he resigned, and now he's trying to retract his resignation. Wasco's denied most interview requests, including those from Keystone Crossroads, and has even been skipping borough council meetings, including one that drew a spillover crowd of 150 people.
Ms. Mayor needs to resign.
This is a borough council meeting. I expect him to be here. So if he is so proud to stand by his statements, then he should be proud to face you.
I mean, it made me think, don't they give psyche vows for these positions around here?
Lifelong resident Elijah Cross, York County NAACP President Sandra Thompson, and James Johnson, a Baltimore transplant, were some of the dozens of people who spoke for nearly 2.5 hours that night. And Thompson wasn't the only one who remarked on Wasco never showing up. Municipal attorney Matthew Battersby says he doesn't exactly have to.
And that's a problem. Because, you know, we do not, you know, have a call to remove anybody from office just for not showing up.
As mayor, Wasco is not especially powerful. He's unpaid, votes only to break a tie, and has some control over the police department. Pay, power, and duty for elected leaders vary among the state's 2,500 municipalities. But one consistency is elected leaders cannot be removed from office absent most criminal convictions unless the state legislature gets involved.
I've never actually seen that done in the past 30 years I've been practicing law. You know, they've never gone that far up the line, shall I say.
Utah and Mississippi are the only other states with rules that strict, but there's quite a continuum. Political scientist and William & Mary professor John McGlennon says as you go west across the country, people tend to have more direct control over removing elected officials from power. He says this pattern is tied to the progressive movement at the turn of the 20th century. It was based in the West and the upper Midwest. And officials themselves had to support increasing their own accountability. So if the problem is corruption,
it's easier to adopt the reforms in places where the problem isn't greatest. Places like Pennsylvania, which were at that time pretty heavily dominated by special interests, had very little interest in changing.
Over a century later, recall policies vary widely. And McGlennon says some are arguably too permissive.
If anybody can bring a recall petition for any reason, can really create a chilling effect on decision makers who have to make what are sometimes unpopular choices.
McGlennon says tough calls as commonplace as a tax hike have led to recalls, but sometimes it's more surprising and location specific.
We've even had cases where public officials have been recalled because they supported public policies like banning of the wearing of furs in a ski resort town in Colorado.
In Pennsylvania, there's no reason good enough. But that doesn't stop some municipalities from having recall ordinances anyway. They're just not enforceable because the state constitution sets out two potential removal processes, both of which are controlled entirely by state lawmakers and contained in the Capitol.
They have to have a notice and a full hearing, and then two-thirds of the Senate have to vote on it.
There have been 22 different bills proposed since 1979 to allow for local recall elections in Pennsylvania. But stakeholders say local recall and removal just aren't legislative priorities. Emily Previty, Keystone Crossroads.
Visit KeystoneCrossroads.org to see a map of how different states handle recalls. More than long lines or scarce parking, there's one thing that'll keep patrons from attending plays without fail: high ticket prices. Now, one Philadelphia theater company is trying to boost attendance by letting theatergoers tell them how much a play should cost. Azuka Theater Company is the only one in the country letting people pay whatever they want for its entire show season. NewsWorks Theater blogger Howard Shapiro spoke with Azuka's artistic director, Kevin Glockham, about the company's big gamble.
Kevin Glockham, when I look at a ticket from Azuka Theater Company this season, what do I see where it says normally what the price is?
You will see a phrase that says, pay what you decide, which means you pay after you watch the show. So you decide what you thought the show was worth to you, and then you pay accordingly.
How did Azuka get into this idea?
A member of our board of directors brought in an article from The Guardian newspaper, the British newspaper, about a company in the UK who had done this. And the
ARC, I think it's called ARC.
It's ARC,
right?
Yes, yeah. In a small town called Stockton-on-Tees in northeastern England. And the first sentence of the article, which was written by their artistic director, said, when was the last time you got a postcard from a company you may or may not have heard of a play you definitely have never heard of, and said, I'm going to spend $50 on that this weekend? It just doesn't happen. So the idea is to let people decide what to pay so that they can take the risk out of purchasing a ticket. They can just come and see the show. If it's new and they don't like it, you know, then they don't have to give us anything. And they can, but they can come back and see the next one, and maybe they'll love that one.
Well, you just finished your first show of the three-show season.
We did.
Which was called How We Got On.
Correct.
How did you get on?
We got on very well, actually. We had done a small test of this at the end of last season with a show that we did called Moth. We did three nights of Pay What You Decide. And it did okay. We were pretty happy with it. Not a lot of marketing around it. You know, we just sort of test ran it. We averaged about $10 a ticket. So that's what we had budgeted for this. And I'm happy to say that we made like $16 or $17 a ticket, that the incidence of people not paying was very small. Almost everyone gave us something. And the reservations were insane. I mean, we had completely booked houses for the last 10 or 12 shows. And the best statistic for me was, early on in the process, as the reservations started to come in, we were seeing like 60% of people who had never been to one of our shows.
So far as we all know, Azuka Theater is the only theater in the United States with this project for a full season.
That's right.
Now, Kevin, you're one of the heads of Theater Philadelphia, which is the umbrella group representing theaters. Mm-hmm. So you know firsthand the problems that come with getting money to keep the theater going in the city.
We've got
more than 50 companies that pay their crews and mm-hmm. pay their cast.
Professional companies.
Yeah. And they're always looking for money because they're the arts. So
absolutely.
They have to be. Is this a kind of template, do you think, for other theaters, bigger ones or even smaller ones?
I do think it could be a template for other theaters. There is at least one other foundation who was thrilled by this idea and said specifically they thought this was a direction other people should be going in. We have been charged by Barra to report on our findings at the end of all of this.
That's the
foundation. And so there's a possibility of us being able to sort of send this to other theaters as a how-to guide, like how to do Pay What You Decide in as an efficient and successful a way as possible. Because so far, so good, it has been successful. We got enormously positive response on the whole concept of this. People love the idea of it.
Why?
I think it gives them agency. There's a sense of, I'm making a decision about what this evening has been worth for me. And, you know, I think there is a sense in the non-theatrical community that theater is expensive and exclusive and it's an event. You know, you get theater tickets for your anniversary and it's a big night out. And, you know, it's $15 a ticket. A movie's $12. You know, you can go see a live show now for $15. But this way, I think it gives people an opportunity that they would not normally take because they don't have to put the money down first.
Well, Kevin Glockham, we're eager to see what this project will do next.
You and I, Howie. You and I both.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
around me. Green, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo.
Newsworks Theater blogger Howard Shapiro talking with Azuka Theater's artistic director, Kevin Glackham. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.